this moment, the guns along the Suez are silent. And the planes that fly towards the canal turn back before they cross that airspace. There is a preternatural quiet throughout the front which separates Israel from its Arab neighbors. Indeed, it's only really an occasional terrorist bomb in a Tel Aviv bus station or in a crowded Gaza market that shatters the quiet. But it's an Alice in Wonderland quiet, counterfeit. There is no ceasefire. There is no armistice agreement. There are no peace arrangements. There is only an hour by hour, day by day extension of the silence, the guns. Quiet, which Israel, as Mrs. Meir has said again and again, is prepared to continue indefinitely. Quiet, which Anwar Sadat has said, can last but a brief period. Only that period of time which is required to put the Egyptian house in order, prepare the Egyptian and the Arab armies for the inevitable, to use his word, military solution to what he calls the Palestine problem. And throughout the world, the chancelleries of the governments of the world, particularly in the West, there's an obvious, urgent undertaking to try and widen the crack, to try and broaden the arrangement, the non-arrangement which exists, to prevent a new escalation of violence in the Middle East, to prevent the outbreak of new shooting, to try and use this lull so that it can be developed into some significant peace. The point I'd like to make with you this morning may seem paradoxical, yet I think it is basic, that we will understand the needs of the Middle East, equity and justice and right, only if we accept the proposition, strange as it may seem, that the very urgency for peace, which is so much among us, so much a part of the undertakings of the Western governments particularly, that this very urgency for peace is the major obstacle to a stable peace in that part of the world. That the urgency for peace in the West is counted on by the Soviet and by the Arab governments, that it's part of their tactic, part of their ongoing strategy. They are desirous of painting Israel as obstinate and obdurate and mulish and belligerent and unwilling to compromise, that they are desirous of forcing the West to lean upon Israel, to force compromise after compromise without their signing any kind of binding arrangement until Israel has been so weakened, until her borders have been so foreshortened, until her economy has been so stretched and so weakened that the Arabs can launch a successful attack and eliminate Israel. That is still, unfortunately, the basic aim of Arab policy. The Arabs say this to the West. You want peace? Let Israel make the compromises for peace. And they are very hazy about what promises they are willing to make in return. Get Israel to roll back to the borders of 1967. And then perhaps we'll sit down with them. But of course, we want you to know that even after the rollback, there are still the questions of Israel's accepting all of the 1.5 million now presumed refugees. There is still the question of East Jerusalem, of the status of the the Capitol. There is still the question of the borders of 1956, of the borders of 1948, and on and on and on. Behind each demand imposed, given to the West as a precondition for negotiations, there are the ifs and the buts, which say, but even so, we will not bargain away this right. We will not sit down until. And the until is the crux of the situation. The Arab world, it seemed to me, is still determined. Until which it will accept is the elimination of Israel from the world. I give you two documents. The first was written just a year and a half ago by the Palestine Liberation Organization, and it's this national covenant. You've heard much of the so-called Palestinian peoples, of their growing importance in this part of the world. What is it that they demand? Not the Arab governments themselves, but beyond the Arab governments, these peoples. In 1968, in July, in Cairo, they undertook to set down a covenant. And I think it's important for us to understand the terms in which it's written. One, Palestine is the homeland of the Palestinian Arab people, an integral part of the great Arab homeland. The people of Palestine is a part of the Arab nation. Two, Palestine with its boundaries that existed at the time of the British Mandate is an integral regional unit. Three, the Palestinian Arab people possess the legal right to its homeland. When the liberation of its homeland is completed, it will exercise self-determination solely according to its own will and choice. Four, the Palestine people's personally, the Palestinian personality, rather, is an innate, persistent characteristic that does not disappear, and it is transferred from fathers to sons. The Zionist occupation and dispersal of the Palestine Arab people as a result of the disasters which came over it do not deprive it of its Palestinian personality and affiliation, and do not nullify them. Five, the Palestinians are the Arab citizens who were living permanently in Palestine until 1947, whether they were expelled from there or remain. Whoever is born to a Palestinian Arab father after this date, within Palestine or outside, is a Palestinian. Nine, armed struggle is the only way to liberate Palestine, and is therefore a strategy, not tactics. The Palestinian Arab people affirms its absolute resolution and abiding determination to pursue the armed struggle, to march forward towards the armed popular revolution, to liberate its homeland, and to return it, to maintain its right to a natural life in it, and to exercise its rights of self-determination in it and sovereignty over it. 19. The partitioning of Palestine in 1947 and the establishment of Israel are fundamentally null and void. Whatever time has elapsed because they were contrary to the wish of the people of Palestine and its natural right to its homeland, and contradict the principles embodied in the Charter of the United Nations. Article 20, the Balfour Declaration, the Mandate Document, and what has been based upon these are considered null and void. The claim of an historical or spiritual tie between Jews and Palestine does not tally with historical realities or with the constituents of the statehood in their true sense. Article 21, the Palestine Arab people, in expressing itself through armed Palestinian resolution, rejects every solution that is a substitute for a complete liberation of Palestine, and rejects all plans that aim at the settlement of the Palestine issue or its internationalization. Where is the give? Where is the compromise? Short of the ultimate annihilation, erasement of Israel. I give you in comparison part of the speech which Mrs. Meir gave at the United Nations just 3 weeks ago. Note the difference in spirit, the difference in hope. Mr. President, she said, the whole Middle East is a dramatic demonstration of the emergence of peoples into national independence. Once a domain of colonial powers, it is today an area inhabited entirely by independent and sovereign countries. The Middle East, however, is an area in which national independence has unfortunately not been accompanied by peace, stability, and resultant prosperity. Rather, it is an area of strife and struggle, within the shadows of which lurks an even greater danger to the peoples of the area. the danger of the loss of their long fought for right of determination and their own future course of action. The questions we all face, Israelis and Arabs alike, is whether we forfeit our right to decide our own destiny. That question will only be resolved in the measure that the people of the Middle East succeed or fail in making peace among themselves and by themselves, without hindrance or intervention by any outside power. Recent events in the Middle East have proven yet again that the resort to substitutes and alternatives for direct peaceful solution of the conflict create fertile ground for breaches of promise and mutual suspicion. This, Mr. President, brings me to another basic question which vitally affects the prospects for peace in the Middle East. Unfortunately, the Middle East has for 22 years been the scene of cynical flouting of solemn agreements. International order, the integrity of the UN itself, depend upon the scrupulous observance of international obligations. Unless the members of this august body respect the sanctity of agreements, no treaties can be binding and no pacts can be maintained. And she then goes on to list the agreements of 1948 and 1956, and the hopes of an agreement in the summer of this year on the ceasefire, to talk of Israel's willingness to abide by agreements and to compromise, negotiate all outstanding issues. And she then ends by saying, I therefore call from this rostrum once again, in the presence of the representatives of the entire community of nations, upon the leaders of the Arab nations of the Middle East, especially now upon the new leadership of Egypt, to recognize once and for all that the future of the Middle East lies in peace. This must be achieved by Israelis and Arabs themselves. It will only be achieved by the building of faith and not the breach of faith, by honoring commitments solemnly undertaken and not by undermining them, by negotiation and not by evasion, by talking to one another and not at each other. In short, by the confrontation of peace and not the confrontation of war. It has been the fate of my country that peace has been denied to us by our neighbors since the very emergence of Israel. But has Israel alone been the sufferer? No. All those around us, as well as Israel, have paid the terrible price of endless warfare. Billions of dollars have been spent on armaments instead of on war against poverty, disease, and ignorance. There are now deserts of death where there could be blooming fields. Mr. President, I say this today not in rancor, but in sorrow. I am convinced that all of us in the Middle East will continue to exist as sovereign states. None of us will leave. But we may choose whether we will continue in the sterile course of mutual destruction, whether we will go on hurting each other to no one's benefit, whether we will venture on a constructive course and build our lands separately and together. For each of us to attain the best of life, cooperation with his neighbors is the solution of regional problems. Our borders not only separate us, but they are bridges between us. No people is an island. We are bound to each other by the problems of our region and our world. We can make of these ties a curse or a blessing. Each nation, each land must decide. Death, life, war, peace. War still, unfortunately, lies at the base of almost all Arab policies for the immediate future in the Middle East. They believe that they can win, if not now, in a year from now. Not a year from now. 5 years from now, or 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And why do they believe that they can win? In part because they are more numerous, in part because they have oil, area, peoples whom the West and the East desire to bring into their camp, and in part because they count upon the peace-loving in the West to be inconstant friends of Israel, ultimately to force Israel to compromise its positions in order to gain a breathing space, a temporary ceasefire, a lull in the fighting. And in return, the Arab states promise nothing at all. They talk vaguely of conversation, but not even face-to-face negotiation. The United Nations talks of recognizing the sovereignty of an existing nation. And that is precisely the basic fact which the Arab worlds refuse to undertake. Need we have other proof? I give you the actions of the Arab states just this past month at the United Nations. The United Nations had a debate on the Middle East forced upon it by Egypt. And Egypt, with the backing of the numerous third world states and of the Arab world and the Soviet satellites and the Soviet Union itself, brought in a resolution which it almost managed to push through, a resolution which would have undone the decision of November of 1967, which spoke of an Israeli withdrawal from the territories it had taken in that war, coupled at the same time as negotiations leading to the recognition of the sovereignty of Israel, stable boundaries between Israel and its Arab neighbors. It brought in a resolution which said simply, Israel must roll back, failing to do so will bring on international sanctions. It said nothing of the violations of the ceasefire. It said nothing of the recognition of Israel. It was simply part of the tactic, the first step in forcing Israel to less defensible boundaries, in compacting Israel's defense lines, in moving towards step two or step three in the war of liberation, as the Arabs tend to call it. I give you as a classic case of what the Arabs have in mind, the whole Suez ceasefire crisis. The Arab world, the Soviet knows that the West wants peace. And so they offer the carrot at the end of the stick. A year and a half ago, the Arab world felt that it was sufficiently rebuilt militarily to undertake what General Nasser then called the war of attrition. The cannons began to fire across the Suez. They began to dig into the defenses there of the so-called Bar-Lev line. The war of attrition in its second phase was the infiltration of many of the Fedayeen, many of the terrorists into Israel, to blow up schools, to blow up markets, to blow up buses, to blow up hospitals, to blow up buildings. And little by little, Israel was to be weakened. Her economy was to be stretched tight. The feelings of her people were to become taut. There was to be a war of attrition. Israel's response was to unleash its fighter-bomber force. And these were able to move across, quickly across the canal, and to attack deep in Egypt, to attack military installations, and to inflict heavy losses. The Russians sat down with the Egyptians and began to develop a counter-move. The counter-move was to introduce and to move steadily forward lines of anti-aircraft missiles, the SAM-2s and the more recent SAM-3s. But the Israelis were able to discover a way of shooting out, destroying most of the more primitive SAM-2s, and the SAM-3s could not be deployed fast enough. So the solution? Let's find a time in which, under the cover of a ceasefire, we can move battery after battery of these anti-aircraft missiles into place. So word came out of Cairo that perhaps the Egyptians might have some kind of ceasefire willingness. And the United States government, Secretary Rogers, President Nixon, seized on this news eagerly. And they came to the Israelis and they said, you must. And the Israelis said, but this will happen. And the American government said, we will see to it that it does not happen. And they went to the Egyptians and they went to the Russians and they heard what they wanted to hear. Whether it was said to them or not, no one is certain. But it is certain that the American government went back to the Israelis and assured them that there would be no forward movement of aggressive missiles into the Suez Canal zone. And so the 90-day ceasefire went into effect at midnight of an August Monday, and at 1 a.m. on that August Tuesday, the missiles began to move forward into the Suez Canal zone. And during this entire 90-day period, which ended early this month, the Russians and the Egyptians were able to move battery after battery of these SAM-3 missiles into place so that now they control the airspace on their side of the canal zone and more. Because of the range of these newer missiles, they control much of the airspace immediately over the Israeli defense perimeter. Under the guise of peacemaking, the Arab states and the Soviet increased their war potential. and they have no compunction about doing so. Mr. Riyad, the foreign minister of Egypt, lied brazenly when he was faced with the evidence, which finally the United States government itself had to admit, of this forward movement. He simply denied it, and so did the Soviet. They had gained their advantage. Peace is simply a ploy in order to gain further advantage. It's a ploy which is appealing, and I'm afraid that it's a ploy that can and has worked. How did France, in 1967, accomplish her flip-flop of allegiances? From the middle 1940s, when France was liberated from the Nazis, the French government understood and sympathized with the legitimate undertaking of Jews, particularly the refugees whom they had seen throughout Europe, to build up a state in Israel. And the French government voted for the creation of Israel. The French government helped to supply the Israeli industry and the Israeli army. There were 20 years of the most cordial, happy relationships between France and Israel. And then the much over-lamented General de Gaulle saw that the Arab world was closing some markets to the French franc. And Mr. de Gaulle saw that there was a chance to sell French jets to Libya, the chance to buy much-needed sulfur from Iraq, that the French banking interests were eager in penetrating again into the Arab world. And so what did he do in 1967? He cloaked himself in the role of a peace-loving man, of a prophet of peace. And he said, Israel acted aggressively in defense of what it assumed to be its rights. Israel acted against my peace-loving principles. Therefore, France can no longer be allied with, interested in such a nation. Therefore, we will sell tanks to Syria, because Syria is such a peace-loving country. And we will sell jets to Libya, because the Libyans need a jet for every 10 Libyan citizens. And we will sell aggressive arms to the Lebanon, because the Lebanese currency is a very valuable one. It's based on silver and gold. Loving peace, pursuing peace, he found a magnificent way of pursuing the franc, pursuing the commercial advantage of France. Yes, it's very appealing to cast Israel as obstinate and obdurate. When Israel must take an act of retaliation, when she must stand up to defend her own rights, the peace-loving people who rationalize their commercial advantage, who rationalize their other geopolitical ambitions under this umbrella, under concern, suddenly find that peace justifies all of the selfishness that, as a government, they had long been desirous of undertaking. Does this ploy work? It worked last summer with the United States government. The United States government, which had been supplying Israel little by little, day by day, with some needed defensive arms, all of a sudden cut off those arms and said, either accept the ceasefire or there is a real chance for peace, let's take it. It worked. And it worked again 2 weeks ago. It worked again with the British government. When Sir Alex Douglas Home, the British foreign minister, at a conference of the Conservative Party in Harrogate, suddenly got up during the middle of this United Nations debate and began to lecture on the compromises Israel must be willing to make in order to bring peace into the Middle East. She must return to the borders of 1967. She must be willing to negotiate Jerusalem. She must be willing to negotiate the refugee issue. There was no talk in this whole speech of the ceasefire violations. There was no talk of how Great Britain could assure Israel that once all this had taken place, the Arab states would recognize her borders. But Sir Alex Douglas Home saw a chance to cast England in a peace-loving role. All they had, he said, of interest, all that was of England's concern was to prevent an escalation of violence, a renewal of violence in the Middle East. Let Israel make the compromise. Again and again, these last months, these last years, All of us have heard the echoes of Munich and of Czechoslovakia and the foreign ministries of the West. Burdened by the desire of all people of goodwill for peace, burdened by the understandable desire of banks and of industries and of oil companies to protect their investment and to be able to make further profit in the Middle East, these governments have jumped for the ploy which the Arab states have begun to undertake so skillfully and have begun to lean upon Israel as if Israel was the obstacle to peace, as if somehow Israel's obstinacy, its desire to live, stood in the way of the peace, the well-being, and the prosperity of our world. And we see this also among many of our neighbors and many of our fellow citizens. The peace movement is at full tide in the United States. It began as a movement to withdraw us from a useless, misbegotten war in the Far East, and has become now a tide of neo-isolationism. It's become now a desire to disembarrass ourselves from all foreign political entanglements, as if America could withdraw behind our oceans and live at home, nursing our own internal problems and allowing the world somehow to solve its own, as if we were not the major power in the world. And I hear it again and again in this city and elsewhere. Why must Israel be so obstinate? Why can't Israel make the first offer? Why can't Israel roll back to the borders of 1967? And when you talk of the non-defensibility of these borders, well, they lived within them for a number of years. Yes, but the Arabs were building up. But you must trust the Arabs. Nasser wanted peace. Nasser wanted peace? Hundreds upon thousands of people believe that Nasser wanted peace. He wanted peace in 1956. He wanted peace in 1967. But it said so. He said so on television. I heard him. The gullibility of the American people to believe that what a man says for American political consumption is the policy of a nation is beyond belief. Nasser, in his death, suddenly became an apostle of peace. This man who led his country into three disastrous wars, two against Israel, one in the Yemen, who lost three wars, whose whole policy of revolution, of social revolution, was aborted because of his megalomania for conquest and domination in the Arab world, this man has suddenly been transformed into an apostle for peace. Where did he speak of peace? Where is a single act taken in behalf of peace, a single willingness to compromise? The Israeli government has again and again and again and again and again said, sit down with us. Any place, any table that you want, any shape to the table, any level of political embassy, sit down, face to face. There's no issue we won't put on the table. Sit down with us. Rhodes, New York, have it where you will. The chair is empty. The Nasser's never come. And they will not come as long as they believe that ultimately the West will abandon Israel, as long as they believe that the peace ploy will allow them to piecemeal cut Israel down to manageable size. And that's the danger. Yes, Israel wants peace. All men must. But peace cannot be had simply for the want. Peace isn't simply something that you can say, I need it, therefore it is. Men must be peaceful. A region must be peaceful. It cannot be chaotic and turbulent. There must be a desire on both sides for arrangements. Then there can be peace, and not till then. And I'm afraid that any of us who want peace today, peace tomorrow in the Middle East are going to be disappointed. The Middle East, the Arab Middle East, is in turmoil. Nation after nation is undergoing putsch and revolution. We saw the destruction in Jordan. We have seen the emergence of new kinds of power combinations between Libya and the Sudan and Egypt. We've seen a bloodless revolution in Iraq, bloodless at least in its first stage. We have seen the unrest of Syria and a bloodless revolution there. There will be other bloody revolutions in the near future. The Middle East is going through a social turmoil. Feudalism is at an end. There are all kinds of radical groups preaching social revolution. There are the traditional wars of class societies. Ultimately, there will be some resolution, some kind of emergence of a responsible Arab leadership with a responsible Arab followership. Perhaps then there will be men who will talk and who will listen. But until then, I'm afraid that the Middle East will be a land of demagoguery and of demagogues. A land of violent words and violent actions. Yes, we want peace in the Middle East, but sometimes peace can be had only at the price of a confrontation of power until peace can be made. What's different, really, between the confrontation of Israeli power and Arab power, balancing off of these powers, and the confrontation of the East and the West, of Russia and the United States, which has taken place over the last 30 years? It's dangerous. It wastes money on military equipment, but it somehow manages to hold peace. It holds off war. Perhaps we ought to be able to devise better instrumentalities to arrange peace, but we have no other instrumentality. And when the blood is up, a man, a nation, must ultimately defend itself. I pray that there will be some kind of arrangement in the Middle East which will allow the present ceasefire to continue. I pray that the Arab world will recognize the value to it of peace. The value to it in terms of social progress, in terms of schools and hospitals and standards of living. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the Arab world is prepared to look realistically and reasonably at these problems. And I am sure of this, that they are counting on the impatience of the West. They are counting on the peace-loving urgency which is manifest in the West in order, over a period of time, to gain their way, this way, the elimination of the state, the elimination of Israel. There's an old principle in our tradition that one always ends a book on a word of hope. The Arabs say, if not now, a year from now, if not a year from now, 10 years from now, we lose a third round, there will be a fourth. If we lose the fourth round, there will be a fifth. There is no certainty that this Arab mathematics must, in fact, take place. There is no certainty in history. The only certainty that I know is that the Guardian of Israel does not slumber and he does not sleep. That our history is four times as long as the history of the Arab peoples. And we have somehow survived. We have found the courage and the determination, the will. This people, our people, has been beleaguered before and has not broken. And we have been besieged before and we have not surrendered. None of us know what lies in this confused world beyond tomorrow. The allegiances and the alliances of our world are quixotic things. We fight the Soviet between every war. We fight with the Soviet in every war. The Soviet voted to create the State of Israel and is now the enemy of the State of Israel. Who knows what tomorrow will bring? What we do know is that time must be bought. We must take the long look. There are no quick, easy solutions. And that those who love peace and would pursue it must pursue it with care rather than with passion. And must understand that in the pursuit of peace, nations have been lost and peoples have had to give over their freedoms. Mr. Chamberlain gave to Mr. Hitler Czechoslovakia in order to gain peace in our time. And what did he gain? War in his time. But when the demagogues and those who are aggressive and those who have no compunction, who are amoral politically, gain their objective, be it Czechoslovakia, be it Israel, they are go for more. There is no satiety. There is no limit to their appetite. Unless the nations of the world show that they are willing to be steady, unless our government is willing now to undertake a continuing policy of friendship and military support for Israel, and to say, yes, we want peace, we in the West, but we will not compromise the sovereignty, the existence of Israel in order to gain it. Unless we are willing to make that kind of statement now and pay the price now, the price will, in lives and the price in money will be much larger a year from now or 10. Israel has said that her price to return to the bargaining table, given the failure of America to be able to force what America has called the rectification of the missile movements of during the ceasefire, is a guarantee from the United States government that at least for 2 years she will continue to supply Israel with needed counterbalancing arms, so that one day America will not suddenly turn to Israel and say, cease fire, cease your activity, compromise what we tell you to compromise, for we want peace. You are expendable. I believe the American government will make such a guarantee. When it does, there will be some time. And pray God that during that time, the wisdom of the world will find a way, formula perhaps, to bring about some arrangement in the Middle East. But let us not be impatient. And let us remember the evil that good men have been known.